Hey guys, welcome back to the third part of the July 1983 coverage of Pacific Comics. Next up is Somerset Holmes. Now, I've been looking forward to reading this. I've heard about Somerset Holmes on and off throughout my journeys with 80s independent comics and beyond. But I've heard about the book frequently, particularly whenever I look into more mystery-oriented books, mystery, things like that. Somerset Holmes always comes up. So this was pretty cool to finally take a second and sit down, well, more than a second, to sit down and read this. Now this, first of all, the cover here, we have a cover by Brent Anderson, Al Williamson, and Joe Chiodo, with it's got a little inset for the second story, and that was by Al Williamson and inked and colored by Brent Anderson. So the first story, the main story, is Somerset Holmes herself. It is indeed a her. The cover is very, airy, feathery kind of coloration. I mean, everything is distinct, but it's not, I don't find it to be photorealistic or an attempt at that, but it is leaning towards a sense of realism as opposed to a more cartoony kind of art. My handle of the vocabulary is not very good in describing the art, but it, to me, I can tell that it is different. I also can tell that Joe Chiodo was involved in this. I recognize his coloring. Al Williamson, maybe not so much. I don't recognize Williamson whenever I see it, apparently, but Chiodo's colors, I definitely do. Individual standing, kind of hiding. On the left-hand side of the cover, we see down a slight alleyway or maybe a short hallway. At the end of that, there is a fire escape above a gentleman standing in a trench coat holding a .45, like he is chasing this person that we see on the right foreground because they are hiding on this side of some sort of break or division or other building, if it's an alleyway, something like that. So she has her back against the building, and then going past her into the cover on the left-hand side is a hallway alleyway, and that is where the individual that is chasing her is standing. She is somewhat in disrepair. The shoulder of her blouse is torn. She is pretty hippie as far as the cut in the skirt that she's wearing. Actually, it looks to be the split in the skirt, going probably all the way up to where the hip joins the torso. So it's showing her full leg on this one leg. The other is kind of obscured in the shadows, and she's shrinking away from the opening of the alleyway that is to her right as she is leaning back against this wall trying to hide. Inside front cover is a kind of a little different story, putting it all together, a behind-the-scenes visit with America's premier independent comic company and our hot new baby. And it's got pictures, black and white pictures of several individuals that we maybe have not seen before. The Shanes, Steve and Bill. I apologize if that's not how you pronounce it. Bruce Jones, Brent Anderson, April Campbell, who turns out to be the editor for this, I believe. Yeah, and co-plotter, but she's the editor. So we see there's one other person here that Steve... No, maybe everybody is there. So, okay. The story. We are following a young lady as she is walking on the berm on a road at night. And looking at it, it appears perhaps to be the woman from the cover, the outfit is similar enough that this is probably her. But she's walking at night. She's walking towards us. The first panel is an aerial shot of the moon. And then we pan down on the next panel to the street. And in subsequent panels, this is a nine panel page. She is walking towards us till we just see the legs and then the feet and then the side of her. And the camera zooms past her as she is also walking towards us in panel 7, we see headlights, and then as she is walking past, the headlights are also getting closer to us as well. Final panel of the page, she has kind of turned to look over her shoulder because she has noticed the headlights as well. Next page, 9 panels. Headlights, lady putting her hand up in front of her eyes so she can kind of see. Bigger headlights, she finally has decided that something is not right. She's attempting to maybe run. Maybe she's going to jump over the side of the hill that the road is on. As she attempts to run, one of her shoes is flung off her foot and bounces off the headlight of the car. It's that close. Then we see closer. Then we see it strike her. And we see something fly through the air. Next page is just a third of a page with three panels. And the other two-thirds of the page, Somerset Holmes, written by Bruce Jones, all black with the results in the lower right-hand corner of the page of the young lady being struck by the car. She's laying here on the ground disheveled. One shoe is gone and her purse has all of her things that she was carrying scattered out as the purse had been flung through the air. Next page, we see that she is laying here potentially unconscious. We see a mouse, a little field mouse, that apparently is not scared by this human being. And the next panel, we show a more close-up of her face laying here. I apologize that this might seem a little broken here for a minute. One of our cats, I'm cat-sitting because my wife is running errands as I record, and our youngest female cat, Aubrey, apparently needed something and was trying to tell me what she needed, so I needed to attend to that. Anyways, I think we see this young lady, and she is laying here with this mouse running by, but her eyes are open. So at first, I thought that she was just dead, you know, with her eyes open. But then the next several panels, we see her sit up and kind of recovering as much she can to what has happened. And she's checking out her clothing and feeling herself and reflecting that perhaps she's a bit beat up from the ordeal. She climbs back up the little hillside that she dove over up to the road level and is walking down the road and finally realizes or gets fed up with the fact that she only has one shoe on. So she takes it and throws it away as she continues walking. She walks down the road until she gets to the a sign here, a shingle for Dr. Jacob Hinkle Family Medicine. She goes up to the door and knocks until he comes in, and he admits her, gives her a quick once-over, and then tells her to, here, go ahead and put these on. Let me take the clothes that you have, and I'll put them in the washer. You put this on, and then I'll come and further check things out, you know, when I get back. The cursory was that you definitely will live, but then we'll do a little bit closer inspection. Meanwhile, fill out these forms, and it's just the standard medical new patient kind of forms. So she's filling them out and looking around, seeing everything, all the doctor accoutrement. She goes and checks out his diplomas that doctors always seem to have hanging on the wall because it proves that they are what they say they are, I guess. I don't know. I have probably four diplomas and any number of other certificates and stuff having to do with work that I've done. I don't have any of them on display. So I've never understood why that's necessary, or it struck me as kind of funny. So she goes over to the weights as she's fiddling around and weighs herself, sits back down on the exam table here, and then realizes that seems to have been a little while. So she looks at her watch to confirm that, and she realizes that her watch somewhere along the way came off. So she looks over here on the counter, and we see, for the second time, we see a clock. And between times, it is about 40 minutes difference between the two times that we did look. So at the very least, the doctor's been gone 40 minutes, leaving her to fill out these forms. She walks out and starts, raising her voice, yelling, quote unquote, to try to find where he is. And she walks around the house and finds him just sitting in a study. And as she's talking to him and she reaches out to touch him, he pitches forward out of the chair with a dagger in his back. Just as he hits the floor, the phone rings. And somebody's asking her, did you get it? And she said, what? Did you get it? Is he dead? How'd it go? And she said, but, and then the person realizes that it's not who they thought and says, say, who is this? And about this time, the doctor manages to stand up because he's not dead and moans something Nichols, N-I-C-K-E-L-S, and then as he's walking to her, he finally crumples to the floor dead. So she runs back over to the phone and engages the operator, and she's about to tell gets the operator to connect her to the police, and she's about to tell the police officer there that takes the call what is going on, but she notices over here a big window curtain, and under the curtain she sees shoes, like somebody is standing behind the curtains. So she finally decides that discretion here is the better part of keeping her ass alive, and jumps out the window. Now, mind you, she is partially clothed. I'm not sure what's going on. So she picked up her dress that she was wearing when she went out and was looking for the doctor, and is walking around out of the dress, but holding it in front of her in some form of humility. Right? Is that the word, humility? So she jumps out the window, still clutching the dress, and at some point she continues her journeys down the road and puts the dress on, walking around until she gets probably into a town and finds a bar still open, and goes into the bar, asks to make a phone call, and they say, yeah, there's a payphone over there. And then she says, well, can anybody loan me a dime? I don't have a dime. And so one of the dudes here at the bar, maybe he's a little bit inebriated, says, hey, you know, I'll give you a dime for a little something, something later. Here, I'll collect. And then she goes to the phone and attempts to call the police again, directs them that there is a dead body at this house, and then hangs up. Goes on into the women's room, and while she's in there, somebody comes in to rough her up. Looks like it must be another patron at the bar. It's not the dude with the... that gave her a dime. But this dude is a little bit more serious. He comes up behind her, holds a knife to her throat, and says, okay, baby, you know what I want. Just cooperate. But she slams him into the mirrors that's on the wall behind him, which kind of disorients him, maybe even hurts him a little bit. Flips him over. The knife pitches over here to the side. And as he's crawling across the floor to kind of grab the knife, she kicks the knife away, slams him in the stall door, because it's a bathroom with stalls. He swats her into a sink. She rips a paper towel dispenser off the wall and throws that at him, and then kicks him on into the stall so that he pitches forward towards the commode. Well, she jumps up and grabs the bar at the top of the stall because it's got doors on it. She swings using that bar, gets him in a... is it a tope suicide? No, she's... well, and anyways, I forget which move it's called, but it's the one where the wrestler has his shoulders on... their knees on the wrestler's shoulders and is about to flip them backwards. But instead, using that bar, she pitches him forward and slams his head into the commode and then flushes it. Soon as she finishes, apparently, for whatever reason, I'm not sure, a couple of the other dudes that were in the bar comes in with a cop. There she is, cripes, what's she done to Harvey? Police, ma'am, would you come with me, please? And she turns and heads toward the window and leaps out the window. And the cop yells, lady, wait! She runs out here and runs on down the road. That she keeps encountering the same road, right? And just keeps going further and further. I wonder if that's some sort of symbolism, or... that's kind of curious. Yeah. Anyways, every time she leaves an encounter, she finds herself on the same road, continuing the journey that seemingly started at the beginning of the issue. So, once again, she is now, though, somebody was waiting for her to leave this bar, waiting on a motorcycle. I'm not sure. Let me flip back and see if this motorcycle... okay. When she jumped out of the doctor's office, there was somebody here, there was somebody here watching, because we have a gloved hand placed on the side of a house, as if somebody is watching from behind the corner of a house as she runs away. And then she passes a dude standing holding the wall of the bar up next to a motorcycle as she goes into the bar, and he's just lighting a cigarette, just chilling out there. So... apparently, that is the dude. He followed her from the house. He may or may not have been the one that killed the doctor. It'd be interesting if he is, because whoever that was left in the room hiding behind the curtains unless they took their shoes off and put them at the bottom of the curtain, that old trick to throw somebody off. But she runs away from that person and encounters this dude with the motorcycle seemingly already outside. So I don't know. But he followed her to the bar, and now she is on her own again, and he is following her. They're going down. This time it's not the street road, though. She just runs into the woods, and she encounters an embankment. And as she is running, she pitches over the embankment and falls and ultimately is able to scramble up the other side. Well, the motorcycle didn't know the embankment was there, and so he zooms up into the air and fiery crashes into the low point between the two high points that the embankment is one side of. And then she climbs up the side and realizes what, something stuck in my belt, a key, she says. Yeah, I'm not sure where that came from. So she does, I guess, ultimately make it up to that same road, because now a truck flags her down and asks her if she needs a ride. Somebody now is at the doctor's office, and they see that the doctor is dead. They look at where she started to fill out the patient form, but there's nothing on it, so she didn't really write anything. And then looks like whoever's at the doctor's office here pulls out a drawer on his desk and reaches for a key ring, but there's no key on the ring. So we have a panel of this male person holding up the ring, showing us there's no key on it. Then the next panel, we see the girl holding up the key. So somehow, some way, she got the key, or it was given to her. I don't know, except the guy fighting with her in the bar. Nobody's been close enough to plant something on her. Anyways, they're driving on down the road towards, he says he's going to Fairvale. She says, yeah, that's fine. As to her name, and as they're driving, they pass a sign for a housing development named Somerset Homes, Better Living for a Better Future, on Route 33. And so as they pass the sign, she tells him that that's her name. Somerset's my name, Somerset Homes. I don't know, I can't really tell if she doesn't remember or if she's just giving him a bogus name just to throw him off. Either way, though, so she takes on the name Somerset Homes, and interestingly enough, that is the name of the book. So there we go. Next is an editorial from April Campbell about the book. And here, so many pages in, like 20-some pages. Let's see, what is it? It is 24 pages in. We finally have the indicia for the book. Oh, I hate that stuff. I like it to be on the inside front cover. Ugh, that annoys me. But next is an ad. Next page is an ad. Pacific Comics continues to lead the way. Six books, five of which now we have talked about. The only one left that they advertise is Vanguard, coming up. Don't worry. And then we have a short story to fill out the issue. This is eight pages. It's entitled Chapter 1, Jungle Peril. And the main character's name is Cliffhanger. Two words. Cliffhanger. Get it? Cliffhanger. Yeah, okay. I thought that was, you know, moderately clever. This comes to us from Bruce Jones, penciled, inked by Al Williamson, colored by Joe Chiodo, and lettered by Ed King. So this is very much patterned after, like, old movie serials. It very much felt that way because the story is apparently set in South America in 1938. So we start out with the pages are... anywhere from 6 to 8 panels a page. Five to eight panels. So the first page, 6 panels, 2 columns of 3, all in black and white, just like your movie serial would start. First says a Pacific serial, and then the first one, top right, says Cliffhanger. Middle left, screenplay by Bruce Jones, directed by Al Williamson. Middle right. Chapter 1, Jungle Peril. And then the bottom two are just some background information about South America, the Isthmus of Panama, exotic species, you know, whatnot. Then we click into color. We have several panels of animals here to show you how exotic the location is. A jaguar, a rhea, which is a big flightless bird, for those of you, if I didn't pronounce it right, or don't know. It kind of resembles an ostrich, but if you see a rhea, they look a little bit more muscular, and that are a little bit, they look fuzzier, a difference in the feathers. And then there's a picture of a hummingbird here. Plane flying overhead, and our young lady, who is going to be our protagonist, who maybe we catch her name. I didn't write it down, so I'll have to see as I flip through this. But she is flying the plane, and the plane unfortunately encounters some issues and goes down into the jungle. She was on the radio and maydays. She has a chance to mayday, but she gets no response until the plane crashes, of course, and she has to exit. She says, let's see, Tierra del Fuego is south. I know that much. I was heading towards the Zingo, which joins the mouth of the Amazon. I have no idea, X-I-N-G-O. I know B-I-N-G-O, because that was his name-o. But in the Amazon, yeah, so she's flying over the Amazon. She's crashed. She decides to, I guess, head south, because that was the last heading that she knew where it ended up. I don't know. I might head to the river and then follow the river out. But, I mean, that might take a while, I understand. But you're more likely to encounter people to help if you go to... I always wonder why people don't do that. If I am lost and I know there is a water source nearby, I would head to the water source, because if I'm looking for help, that probably is my best chance to encounter someone else doing something around the water source, rather than out in the middle of the woods somewhere, just hazarding to encounter some, you know, a river or a creek or whatever. Go downstream. Anyways, that's what I would think. Okay, if you're not in a situation to just light yourself somewhere and wait for rescue. Now, I think more often than not, as far as rescue theory, that probably is the best way to handle when you don't know where you are. Find a safe place, hunker down until somebody finds you, because if they start searching for you, ultimately they will find you. But if that's not the case, I've always thought go towards water, you know. This has been Ed's Survival Tips. So she is traipsing through the jungle and starts encountering some issues. She falls down in the mud and gets everything wet now. As she's clambering in the mud to try to get out, she's attacked by an alligator. A crocodile. And then pulling herself out of the mud, she grasps a large constrictor of some sort and uses it to pull herself out to extricate herself, but then finds herself in danger because the constrictor realizes and starts to envelop her. As she is probably reaching the end of her ability to do anything to escape, a gunshot rings out and the head of the snake explodes. Now we see a dude here, and he is using a repeating rifle from, I don't know, a ways away, so that was a pretty damn good shot. He didn't raise it to his shoulder or anything. He shot from the hip and got that snake in the head from, I'd say 15, 20 yards? That's not bad. This apparently is going to be Cliff Hanger. He also smokes, I would say, either Lucky Strike or maybe Pall Mall, one or the other. Well, I don't know. In 1938, I'm not sure which was around. We'll go with Lucky Strike. So, yeah. He's smoking and everything, and he tells the girl, you know, it's a good thing I was here, and da-da-da. She says, oh, well, I could have rescued myself, yada-yada-yada. We have some gender headbutting here, and in the course of their conversation, she realizes, wait a minute, you said you have a plane? He's like, oh, yeah, it's, you know, over here. And she's like, well, then let's get the hell out of here. He says, well, we could, but there's a hole in my gas tank. Well, what do you want to do then? How were you planning to get out? Well, I saw your plane come down, so I was making my way over there to see if I could pirate your gas tank, borrow your gas tank and put it on my plane and get out of here. She said, well, yeah, come on, let's go do that. And then she stops to think and is like, by the way, what are you doing here? I know what I'm doing here. He's like, oh, I was gun running and, you know, ran into some plane troubles. And she's like, wow, you sure are honest about it. And he's like, yeah, well, you know, I know what I do, and most of the people that I deal with know what I do, so there's really not any reason to hide it. And now you know what I do. So as they're walking, they have fixed the gas tank, and they're kind of just I don't know, biding time here or something, but it starts to rain. And then the dude realizes, oh man, we need to hurry and get in the plane and take off, because if things get too soupy, we won't have any kind of runway to get off anyway. So they run to the plane, but they're in some kind of maybe the jungle equivalent of an arroyo or something. But his plane is caught in, a gully washer, some kind of flash flood. And it sweeps them down and over a big, waterfall. And we're told all of this has been in color, right? The first page, six panels in black and white. The other, the other seven pages, however many panels, have been in color until the very last panel on the last page. And it flips back to black and white, shows the waterfall, and says, "Don't miss chapter 2, Claws of Death." Much like the serial would be. So that was kind of cool. Cliffhanger. Yeah. Cliff. That was the Rocketeer's first name, wasn't it? Cliff? Yeah. Okay, next page is a full-color portfolio advert from Shanes & Shanes, 379 portfolios. This was in one of the other books I've talked about. Portfolios range anywhere from $12 to $70 for them. Back page is another, back inside cover, is another series of black and white photos with some text talking about Campbell, Anderson, Cliff Jones, Al Williamson, Ed King, Steve Shanes, Paul Tallerday, who is the production coordinator. That's a new one. Just showing kind of a day in the life, I think. And then outside back cover, next issue, Somerset finds a friend, but can she trust him to help her flee her pursuers? Strangers on a Train. Don't miss it. On sale in September. And kind of a noir deco kind of quasi artwork on the back here to grab your imagination and get you to buy the next issue. All right. Final issue for Pacific Comics July 1983 coverage is Twisted Tales. This is a Bruce Jones horror anthology. The cover is penciled, inked, and colored by John Bolton. And it is a young lady in a cave, a cavern, and she's shrinking against one wall of the cavern. There is a tunnel that kind of arcs around and behind her to the right. It's lit, and coming up that tunnel is something casting a shadow just out of her vision, because her vision is taken up with the passage that she's in being semi-filled with water and a dead body with a really effed up face floating by her, and she is gasping at that. Twisted Tales number 4. By the way, let me take a look here. Somerset Holmes, the main story, you can find reprinted in the Eclipse Somerset Holmes from 1986. So that's about 3 years later than this. I don't know how easy that is to find, so I'm not sure really if that's of any benefit at all. The Cliffhanger story was reprinted in 2003 by Insight Studios in Al Williamson's Adventures. Now, so that would be cool to get that book and be able to read all of these back to back. That'd be interesting. I might search that out. All right, Twisted Tales. Let's see here. This first story is entitled The Well. No English reprints. The second story, Nick of Time, no reprints at all, at least on the Grand Comics database. And the third story, Secret Place, that is reprinted in Bruce Jones' Outer Edge from Innovation, issue number 1, 1993. So, about, 10 years after this came out, one of the stories got reprinted, but apparently Bruce, that middle story, I guess he never sold it to anybody to redo. All right, inside front cover are letters and no names that I recognize. And, thank you, Pacific Comics and Bruce Jones, the indicia on the bottom of the inside cover. That is the place. I like that. All right, The Well. We're told October 10, 1954, and this comes to us from Mr. Bruce Jones, who scripted it. penciled and inked by John Bolton, colored by Steve Olaf, and lettered by Ed King. This involves the Kellogg's, Mark and Mrs. So it's Mr. and Mrs. Kellogg. They've just moved into a new house. We see outside, then we see inside the house. They're sitting here kissing in front of a fireplace, and she is somewhat disheveled, like they were in the process of getting busy, and she stopped them. And then no sooner do they get done with the conversation as to why she stopped. And she stopped because she's like, dog, we still got stuff to do. We still got to unpack. And he's reaching for his belt and thinking, yeah, unpack this. Yeah, anyways, sorry. So just as they're talking, there's some kind of AR, many, many, many O's, like a how, a ooh, coming from somewhere. Not very loud, but it was loud enough to get their attention. So they're looking around, not sure where this came from. So he goes, you know, over here into the boxes and whatever. And they do happen to have a flashlight handy because we all know that when we move into a brand new place, when night comes, we always know exactly where our flashlights were packed, right? Boys and girls? Yeah, no, please. I can never find a damn flashlight when I'm moving. So anyways, they have one and they go outside and they're looking around and they're like, oh, well, look, over there, there's a well. I didn't know we had a well on the property. So they head on over, and they're scoping out the well. And Mark here looks down it, and it's like he thinks he hears something. So he looks at it, and he feels that everything is secure enough in the well. He is going to use the well retriever rope, right, on the bucket that brings up the water. He's going to use that and the mechanism over the well, which apparently is still in good enough shape, to descend into the well because he thinks he heard something. I'll be honest. I don't know if I could ever hear something in a well that would make me want to climb down it, unless it was like my wife's voice or something, like, you know. But otherwise, if everybody that is I'm worried about is up here with me and I hear something in the well, my first impulse is not going to be to climb into the well. I don't. But then I guess that's why I'm never going, my story's never going to be in a comic book, right? Because I don't do anything cool. I just make podcasts. Sorry, I threw myself off with all that. So he hands Ms. Kellogg the light and says, here, you know, shine this down the well. I'm going to climb down. And he does. And they're able to communicate back and forth a little while until finally, you know, she gives a couple calls and gets no response. So she decides, well, what's good for the goose? And so she, what does she do? She puts the flashlight in the waistband of her dress. And she then descends into the well using the same technique that Mr. Kellogg did. Apparently it worked because he got down there, but she lost contact with him. And she gets down there. We see several panels of echoes. Honey, can you hear me? And in the bottom of the panel, you see me, as her call is echoing. Mark, honey, I'm frightened. Please answer me. Mark, don't tease. Please. Please, please, please. So that I thought that was pretty cool. She's walking around, and then she sees let me check here. Is this Mark that she sees? Yes. She sees Mark, who is floating in the water in the bottom of the well here. But the one of the last things that she did hear from him is that he found a passageway in the bottom of the well. So it's not just a hole into the ground. The hole goes down and breaks into a passageway that is filled partially with water. She goes in and it's up to, yeah, maybe her knee or just a little bit above the knee. So she's walking around and the body floats by and it's Mr. Kellogg, Mark, with a really effed up face here. Something happened to him. It messed up his face. Apparently that was enough to kill him. She screams, oh, and she starts running away, runs back down the passageway towards the entrance, towards the well with the rope. We see a little bit of light coming from above. I don't know what that is. Moonlight, I guess it is. But she runs up and grabs the rope, but realizes that the rope is too slimy to climb up. It wasn't too slimy to climb down, apparently, but now it's too slimy to climb up. She hears that something is following her, and just as she makes another attempt to try to climb out of the well using the slimy rope, something catches up with her from behind and rips her clothing quite off. Because the next panel, that whatever this thing that grabbed her is gone, but she's laying here very disheveled with everything torn off, and we find out that apparently she wasn't wearing any panties, because in the way she's laying here, we have a little bush exposure here, which, interestingly enough, I'm curious as to why she was running around not wearing any panties, but that's not for me to decide. So she's running around. She realizes, gas. And I think it's the natural gas that she's smelling. She sniffs it and decides that she's going to, I guess, maybe track down that odor. I'm not sure. She just starts walking again. And this is a different passageway. This is not the water-covered passageway. This is a dry passageway. As she's walking down it, she passes a female that is hanging upside down and has apparently been eviscerated. Rounding the corner past this girl, the next is a three-quarter page panel of a creature, insect-like creature. And it says M-M-M-M-M-U-L-C-H-H-H-H-H-H. And then click, click. In paren, so it's mulch, click, click. Yeah, I don't know what all that means. And then the next panel, it says malak lak. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure what that is, but it's some weird kind of creature. And she sees now over here, past the eviscerated woman hanging upside down, is another female body up against the wall, kind of sitting with its knees drawn up to it. She runs, the creature comes close and she backhands it and runs away. And as she runs down this path, she starts passing body after body, partially, fully, different degrees of decomposition. She continues on till she gets to a little passage, and here is a naked female body, partially eviscerated, with, 8 or 10 creatures feeding on the body that look like just miniature versions of this large creature that she passed. So she decides to turn and run down another passageway and is almost intercepted by the same creature or another one. She runs until she runs into the watered passageway again. It's partially filled with water. And she runs out and runs to the rope and starts to try to climb back up the rope. And she starts screaming, "Please help me, help me." And now there's somebody up here. It says, "Hello, hello down there." She says, "Thank God, the rope, pull the rope, please." And it's somebody from the city gas company has come. It's now daylight. And he helps extract her. There is a animalistic growling kind of noise coming from beneath her. She grabs the guy and asks if he has any matches. And he says, "Well, yes." And she grabs those matches and strikes one and drops it down into the tunnels, and it explodes tremendously, the gas leak. And apparently that must have been why the guy was called by somebody else, I guess, in the neighborhood, because they didn't do it. And he was there to check it out, and she blew up the well and probably the house and who knows what else. Next thing she knows, she wakes up in the hospital talking to the doctor here. She's lost one of her eyes, and let's see. The doctor tells her she's pregnant. You'll be happy to know that by some miracle, the fetus you're carrying survived the impact of the explosion and is growing very nicely. By the size of you, I'd say you'll be ready to deliver in about a month. Fetus, she thinks, but that's impossible. I wouldn't be pregnant. Mark was sterile. The creature's young, feeding on the remains of their mother, she thinks. And the doctor tells her, now, Ms. Kellogg, there's no need to look so alarmed. Childbirth is nothing to be afraid of. How in the world she was impregnated, I have no idea. Maybe it had to do with the fact she was running around with no panties on. I don't know, but there we go. So she's carrying the offspring of whatever this bug-like creature was. Next is a page for Silver Heels, coming this fall from Pacific Comics, an advert here, with an illustration by Scott Hampton, 1983. Of, I'm going to presume, Silver Heels, or at least the protagonist of the story. All right, next is The Nick of Time. Let me take a gander at time here. Ooh, okay. Only two books, but it's getting close to as long as the others. This comes to us from Bruce Jones, penciled and inked by Don Lomax, colored by Phil Phillipson, and lettered by Kerry McCarthy. And this story involves Jonathan Kenton, Gene Kenton, and Gloria. So we start off with a gentleman walking into his house. His name is Jonathan. And he sees someone wearing one of those Irish bicycle hats or a touring hat, holding a large knife to a nearly disrobed female who the dude recognizes that came in, Jonathan, as his wife. So somebody has grabbed his wife and is holding a knife to her throat. Turns out Jonathan has been messing around with this dude's wife. And this dude has now come for revenge. So basically, what is happening is the dude wants some things done. And Jonathan is going to do them, because if not, this dude is going to kill his wife. Let's see. Gloria is this dude's other dude's wife, Jonathan. Jonathan Kenton, Gene Kenton, and Gloria. So Gene is Jonathan's wife, and that's who's being held at knife point. Gloria is this dude's wife that Jonathan has been messing around with. And so at first the dude tells Jonathan, go and get my wedding ring. I want my wedding ring off of her hand, so go get it and bring it back to me. So while Jonathan is traveling to the other house, because again, he's been having an affair, he knows exactly where to go to find her, we see some reminiscing of how this all started. They met somewhere, looks like they met on the golf course. And apparently the other wife's, Gloria's large bosom is what attracted Jonathan. So he's a boob man. And at one point, Jonathan is a doctor and Gloria called him for a house call. Well, when he got there, he called more than house, if you know what I mean. And that's how it all started. So he goes inside and he finds Gloria unconscious because of what he assumes is Demerol. Finds the wedding ring, and the wedding ring won't come off, but he knows he's got to get the ring. So what he does is he cuts off her finger, and then using a lighter, he cauterizes the wound. Hardcore. And none of this even causes her to stir. So I suspected right here that she's probably already dead. This dude, her husband, probably killed her. And so he does that, goes back and brings the dude the knife. And he's like, oh, brought her finger with it. Nice touch. I didn't think of that. So anyways, you need to go and get, what is it this time? Earrings. You need to go get the earrings she has. I like those earrings. I want them back. So he jumps back in the car. And each trip is timed. There's a sand timer that the guy found, and he's using it. He sets it there, and that's how long Jonathan has to get to the other dude's house, get whatever items, and make it back. Between 12 and 14 minutes, I think, on average, is the timer. It's like a 12-minute timer, I guess. We'll say that. And so, okay, so this time Jonathan takes off a little bit more reminiscing here. But this time, unfortunately, on the way, he gets pulled over by an officer for speeding. And he knocks out the officer and takes off. And so he avoids the officer, causes a big crash. The police car crashes into a bus that Jonathan used to block the way as it's traveling on its route, causes a big conflagration from the crash. But Jonathan is like, or even Dr. Jonathan is, whatever, got to save my wife. So he gets to the other house here and rips the earrings out of Gloria's ears, just rips them out, gets the earrings, takes them back just in time. Well, in the going back and forth and back and forth, Jonathan now has a gun, and he holds a gun on the dude, and the dude says, well, you can go ahead and kill me, but nothing you do will stop me from, you know, cutting the throat of your wife, and she will bleed out while you're worrying about brains and whatever. So he tells him one more time, tells him to go get something, and he goes, let's see, I lost track of what he wants him to get this time. But he sends him back. And this time, Jonathan gets there and somehow the police have been notified that something was going on at that house because he runs into the police there. And he runs in yelling, "Gene, Gene," because that's, I don't know. That's his wife's name. So I don't know why he's calling her name. He should be calling Gloria. But he sees that this body that he's been mangling actually is the dude. Or no, I'm sorry. Let me get this straight. Kenton is the guy. Gene is the guy's wife. So no, he has been getting things from Gene. Gloria is Jonathan's wife. She's the one that's being held at knife point. So Jonathan runs in yelling for Gene to wake up and finds out that the police are there. And it's not Gene, it's the husband. It's Kenton. So Gene and Gloria, we find out, had a little tryst and wanted to get rid of Kenton and Jonathan so that they could be together. Yeah, nice little twist. So it was Gene who was dressed as her husband Kenton, holding the knife on Gloria. And then while Jonathan was gone, presumably being arrested here because he runs into this house where this dude has been murdered, we see Gene, she exposes herself, and Gloria is here, and they are going to live in happily ever bliss after. Full page ad for 6 Pacific books, the same 6 we keep seeing. Next is an ad for a Conrad Thrillology, Tim Conrad. And his book is going to be Thrillology, and it should be available in a couple months from when we're reading these. Next up, final story. Final coverage for the final part of the episode, The Secret Place. Scripted, penciled, and inked by Bruce Jones, colored by Joe Chiodo, and lettered by Kerry McCarthy. Now, this involves Johnny and Mrs. Watkins and Matthew. We start out with a young boy sawing on a fiddle and playing it hot. No, I'm kidding. A young man sitting here just on a little bluff place overlooking a swamp. And we see why. He is a young man that's been taken to Camp Piney by his mother and left here. And he really doesn't fit in. He's the smart, intelligent, geeky kind of guy, let's say. And everyone else, all the other young men here, are the sporty, athletic, actively doing kind of people. And the young man who we're basically going to find out is Johnny, is not athletic. Matthew is the camp counselor. So, taking a rough census here, starting out the story, we have Johnny Watkins, who were given his name, Matthew, the camp counselor, who were given the name, and nobody else gets any names. So let's say that Johnny and Matthew are going to be important, right? Because they have names. Johnny is our point of view. He is our protagonist. Matthew, I don't know, but probably is going to be something nefarious. Let's just throw that out there. So let's read and see, shall we? Oh, and I already told you, this was reprinted in Bruce Jones's Outer Edge, put out by Innovation in 1993, if you want to read this story, The Secret Place. So Johnny is tormented. You know, he retreats into his books, but his books don't do him any good because he's pulled out of his books either by Matthew, the camp counselor, wanting Johnny to get more involved, or the boys that Johnny's with always causing him grief. One of the boys here at the camp, the biggest, is always doing something to Johnny. Here we have several images of him pulling Johnny away from the books he's reading, picking him up and walking over to the edge of the swamp and throwing him in the swamp. Johnny, of course, is upset and he runs to Matthew's cabin that he has been in or around before because he saw Matthew had a gun on the wall, a rifle, and he gets the rifle and runs out with it as Matthew's coming back. Then somewhere along the way, as he's running around trying to hide because he has the gun, Johnny's got a gun? Yeah. He runs until he can't run anymore, and he collapses here in the swamp. And when he wakes up, he sees this idyllic section of the swamp. It's just the most beautiful, picturesque thing he's ever seen. And to me, I don't know. I mean, it just looks like a portion of the swamp. Although it is a quiet portion because we see a deer here, so there aren't any predators around. And as he's looking around, he sees this creature bubble up, a man-shaped creature. And he immediately runs away from the creature. But as he's running away, he does hear the creature say the word friend, among other words that he doesn't recognize. So he runs back to camp, and we have images of him sleeping and trying to eat and being bullied and trying to play sports and sucking at it. And so he winds up back at this section of the swamp with this creature. And this creature and he become friends. So he starts spending more and more of his awake time away from the camp in the vicinity of the swamp where this creature is, hanging out with the creature. Ultimately, Matthew finds that Johnny is acting kind of peculiarly. And so he starts asking around for Johnny whenever he's not there. Well, Johnny eventually runs around and runs towards, you know, whatever outskirts of camp and finds Matthew there with a police officer as they're going over a dead body. So Johnny finds out that campers at the camp currently are winding up missing, and some of them have been found dead after winding up missing. So now Johnny is worried about this. And he wonders, I wonder if that creature is coming closer to the camp, snagging these people, and then dragging them off into the swamp to do whatever, and then they're just finding the bodies after. So that's what he starts thinking is going on. And he next time he goes to wherever this creature is, he takes his rifle with him. And he plays possum, and then when the creature gets close, he turns on him and shoots him. So Johnny does this and then immediately runs back to camp and gets Matthew and brings him and tells him, you know, hey, here's your rifle. I dropped it right here because I shot this thing and it fell into the swamp and it's been around and I think it's responsible for the killing of the other campers and all that. And while he's telling the story, we see Matthew, and he's getting more and more closer, and he puts a hand on Johnny's shoulder, and the hand wraps around Johnny's throat, and he starts to try to choke out Johnny. And as he's doing this, the creature rises from the swamp and grabs Matthew and hides, drags him into the swamp. And then immediately after that, then all is quiet. After a moment, you are staring in awe at the large silver sphere rising above the quiet water. And as it soars into the sky and vanishes at last in the clouds, you now understand. Your throat moves, and you utter your first words in 4 years. Goodbye, my friend. That was a big point of Johnny. He had gone mute because of his mummy and daddy arguing, I think is what we were told. And mummy decided to treat him by taking him to day camp. And so it worked. Ultimately, right? He saw dead bodies, and he saw an alien, and he was almost killed, and he saw a spaceship, and that is what needed to happen for him to talk again. Not bad. All right, next page is a full-color portfolio advert, the same one we've been seeing in everything this month. Inside back cover is an advert for the hottest female in print, Gita of Alizar, an adult graphic novel by Frank Thorn, available in August. And that is going to be available from Pacific Comics, I believe. Well, you'll be able to purchase it from Pacific Comics, but I don't know if it's officially theirs because I don't remember seeing it on my list of books that I needed to talk about. So maybe I need to revisit that. I don't know. I'll have to see who published that. And then the back cover itself is a full-color advert for Alien Worlds number 4, which I believe is coming up next episode. Let me take a gander here. Yes, next episode I'll be talking about Alien Worlds number 4. Actually, well, I have my list here. Next time out will be for the Pacific Tuesday episode will be Alien Worlds 4, Captain Victory Special number 1, Silver Star number 4, and Twisted Tales number 5. That'll be the first time in a long time that we had back-to-back issues of a book in consecutive months. So that's what you have to look forward to or to suffer through, whichever have you. Next, Pacific Comics, and that will finish up our current season of Pacific Comics. So after talking what is that, August 83, that will put us two-thirds of the way of looking through all of Pacific Comics books while they were a publishing company. All right, guys, that is most certainly everything I wanted to say. We're closing in on yet another hour episode, so these will be three episodes, each approximately an hour long, that you'll be able to digest in the month prior to the next episode. Next out on Newsprint Commando, though, will be a Wonder Woman episode talking about The Brave and the Bold with a special guest star. And then after that, the regular Newsprint Commando, Elf Lord Volume 2, Number 1. So look out for those books, and I will talk to you both times and many times before and a couple times after. And ciao, folks.